Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is presented by Forever Cheese. Learn more at forevercheese.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kara Warren, with my co-host, Joe Salonia. And on today's episode, we have Peter Reinhardt, an award-winning author and pizza expert described as the Gandalf of pizza, a full-time baking instructor at Johnson & Wales University, and a philosopher of life adjacent to pizza. He's also widely acknowledged as one of the world's leading authorities on bread. He's the author of 10 books on bread and 3 books on pizza, including the James Beard Award-winning book cookbook and award-winning Bread Baker's Apprentice and American Pie, My Search for the Perfect Pizza, and the founder and the host of the popular video website, PizzaQuest.com. Peter, welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be here.
Yeah,
it's
man.
It's been a long journey. We've been talking about doing this show together for months and months, and I feel like we finally connected.
Yes, yes. I think.
I gotta know more about you, man. Your resume is quite impressive.
In the end, it's all about bread and pizza, and the kind of can boil down to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think I've always, as a girl from Brooklyn, I've always imagined having a pizza expert on this show and talking about cheese and pizza. So Peter, you're like the super perfect person. And I know Joe is a diehard pizza fan. So this is going to be just a lot of fun today.
Well, if you're from Brooklyn, then every person you know is a pizza expert, right?
Yes.
So much pizza.
Super. Yeah. True. I mean, is there a place in Brooklyn that you would give a shout out to, or would you say most of them are just very good and you can't pick one?
I don't know if I can pick one. First of all, it's been a while since I've been there. There's obviously some new players every day. There's a new player on the block. I always defer to Scott Wiener when it comes to pizza in Brooklyn and pizza in New York, because he keeps me abreast of things. And about 3 years ago, he led a little group of us from Heritage Radio Network on a pizza crawl, starting on the Lower East Side and ending up in Brooklyn. And to be honest with you, I don't have my list in front of me of where we all went, but we ended up, again in Bushwick, but not at Roberta's, but at the other pizzeria in Bushwick that is getting a lot of notice. And I've blanked out on the name. I don't remember if it's Ops or whatever it was. We ended up there, and it was really darn good.
Yeah, and I was going to ask you almost. I was going to put you on the spot about Roberta's, but that's all good. I mean, it's good pizza,
Well, you can't go wrong there, but really, it's hard to go wrong at any pizzeria in Brooklyn. We even, got to the, what's called the Spumoni Gardens, and L&B Spumoni, which is the famous Sicilian place. But we went to about 2 or 3 other Sicilian-style places. And I have to say, each one was different. It's not like there's one kind of Sicilian pizza. There's like however many pizzerias that serve Sicilian, there's that many Sicilian style pizzas. And they're all, when they're done well, they're all really, really good.
Oh, they put the sauce on top of the cheese, or the cheese on top of the sauce? Is that a thing?
There would be some kind of rule, but it really, they all make up their own rules. So some call it the upside down approach, where they put the cheese on first and then the sauce. But then just when you think you've got a rule, then there's somebody else breaking the rule and saying, nobody tells me how to make my pizza. I do it my way. And I still want to call it Sicilian pizza, or I still want to call it Neapolitan, or I still want to call it New York style, because I'm from New York and I do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
There are these styles, right? There's like families of different kinds of pizza now that would even, I think, your average pizza fan could almost try to define now, right?
I remember about 20 years ago, David Rosengarten had a wonderful quarterly newsletter, or every 2 months a newsletter with, where he spotlight things. And he did a whole newsletter episode or issue on pizza. And it was the first one I ever saw kind of break it down into categories. And his categories then were pretty good. They were general. There was like Neapolitan. There was neo-Neapolitan. There was New York. There was Sicilian. And then there was everything else, you know, Americana. And now since then, those four or five categories have been subdivided into about 20 other categories. So there's like, there's not only Neapolitan and neo-Neapolitan, but now there's Neapolitan-ish. And the commentators just keep adding, you know, new nuances to the discussion. And it's not like there's a rule. The rule is whatever helps us to understand and get our head around this growing global sort of expansion of pizza. I mean, pizza is taking over the world. It was always popular, but now it just seems to be out of control.
Is there one, though, that you go to school for in Neapolitan style? It has to be certain flour, a certain tomato, buffalo mozzarella only. The oven has to be meeting specs. And is that the neo-Neapolitan? Or is
no. What you're describing is the Neapolitan. The true Neapolitan style would be, you know, and they about 40 years ago, a marketing team in Naples, of all places, you know, they said, we've got to preserve this method of pizza. So they came up with the Vera Pizza Napoletana rules, which included, you know, that to call your pizza a true Neapolitan pizza, it has to be made in a wood-fired oven at least 800 degrees. It has to be made with a 00 flour. It has to be made with tomatoes from Mount Vesuvius, the San Marzano tomatoes. You know, they came up with about six or eight rules that, and then you had to get certified by a master pizza maker to be able to say that you are making a true Neapolitan pizza. Well, it turned out that, you know, a lot of people in America did get certified. Not all of them were making great pizzas. And there were a lot of other places that said, I know how to make this pizza. I'm not going to get certified. I'm not going to play that game. And their pizzas were as good as anything you might get in Naples. But and even in Naples, there's pizzerias that break those rules and don't want to play by those rules. So it was a cool idea. And the purpose, I think, was noble in that they've got this classic technique. We should at least preserve the sort of the bones of that technique. But then, you know, within the craft itself and the art, and I think that's really what the bottom line of all this is that we're really talking about a craft, an evolving craft. It's not just, you know, sort of it's been set and it's always going to be this way. It's constantly in flux because new artisans and new craftspeople are coming into it, and they're finding that it's not just the rules, it's what you do with those, the tools of the trade, the flour and the cheese. And if I can make a great pizza with an Italian 00 flour, maybe I can make just as good of a one using an American flour or a Canadian flour, or, you know, and it doesn't maybe even have to be 00. These, they start to tweak the rules and find that, again, there's more than one way to the mountaintop in the end.
Wow.
Right, I'll eat it all.
I didn't even realize there was.
What do you think? I'm getting hungry.
Yeah. Agree.
Well, I imagine in the cheese world, it's very similar. You know, there's got to be, you know, there are the defined types of cheeses, but then within those defined types, there's got to be people who are saying, you know, I'm gonna play with those rules and do it a slightly different way. You know, I don't know. I'm guessing, but I would think so. That's why I want to talk to you guys, you know, about cheese, because cheese is such an important part of pizza. But I think in any craft, frankly, there are levels of, you know, sort of as you drill deep into that craft, you'll find that there are rules, and then there are rules that are meant to be broken.
Mm-hmm. Like the flavor rule. I think that's what I was hoping you would go on about, the flavor rule too, because I know, like,
what's this about?
Is for pizza, like between Parmigiano and Pecorino Romano and shredded versus grated. And I was kind of impressed, like, so what is the flavor rule for you in that respect?
Well, I guess you can break down to two. There's two fundamentals when it comes to pizza, in my opinion. Number one, pizza, with all the complexity that we just talked about, you know, over the last 5 minutes of what all different styles of pizza, really pizza is as simple as it comes. It's just dough with something on it. And dough with something on it can be called pizza. It might be called focaccia. It might be called, in another culture, it could be a naan bread with garlic butter on it. Dough with something on it is a type of pizza. And so pizza, sort of, we think of pizza now as a very specifically sort of Italian themed dough with sauce and cheese, or, you know, with one or the other. But in general, categorically, it's just dough with something on it. And then who decides what goes on it is really the person making the pizzas. So that's number one. And then number two is all these other rules about how to make the perfect pizza and how to make the proper pizza and all this. You know, it boils down to, despite the Naples rules and what we call the rules of the pizza police, the only rule that really matters to, I think, a pizza person who's a craftsperson making pizza is the flavor rule, which is this: flavor rules. In other words, if it tastes good, then don't tell me I can't do it. And that's, and I get emails all the time from people asking, you know, they come up with a method they want to try and they would say, am I doing something wrong? Am I breaking a rule if I make my pizza this way? I don't see it in a book like this. And I go, well, how does it taste? And they say, it tastes great. And I say, well, you passed the most important rule, which is the flavor rule, flavor rules. And so I just keep defaulting back or punting back to the flavor rule when it comes to how do you do it. And then all the other rules that exist are just techniques to help you get good at making the pizza that tastes really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Well, such a subtle thing, right? I mean, like cheese, you have just a few ingredients and it can go in many different directions, right?
Right. I mean, is there a rule that says you can only use mozzarella cheese on a pizza? You know, if you're from, if you're doing the true, pure Neapolitan margherita pizza, you use bufala mozzarella, or you can use fior di latte, which is a cow's milk mozzarella, and it should be fresh, not dried, et cetera, et cetera. But is that the only way to top a cheese pizza? No, there's, and does it have to be mozzarella? What about the zillions of other cheeses? What about cheeses that are not even cow's milk cheeses or sheep's milk cheeses, but are, or buffalo cheeses, but are coming from a camel or something like that? If it's cheese and it melts and it tastes good on the pizza, I think you can use it.
I love that.
Big controversy today, by the way, as I say those words, it's making me think of the fact this is now there are non-dairy cheeses, right? There are cashew milk cheeses and vegan cheeses. And, you know, there's a lot of people, pizza purists, who feel that it's an adulteration to try to put something, you know, something that's not a traditional cheese or classic cheese on top of a pizza. But again, you have to then invoke the flavor rule. If that vegan cheese tastes good on the pizza, then you can use it. If it doesn't taste good, if it doesn't work, then that would be the reason to eliminate it, not because it's not made from classic milk.
Right. Yeah. I mean, vegan pizza, that like hurts my heart slightly, but I mean, there are vegans out there that need to eat pizza. So, you know, that has to happen. But so what do you tell people is like the best first step to their own pizza quest? Like, is it like just finding key ingredients, or is it like learning to make pizza dough first? What's like the ideal first step, you think?
That's a great question, because, you know, you can start at a different number of places, but I think the key to a great pizza, and when I wrote my first pizza book, which is called American Pie, My Search for the Perfect Pizza, the original title of the book was My Search for the Perfect Pizza. And of course, the publisher wouldn't let me use that title because it was too long to fit on the back spine of the book. So they said, we got to come up with a short title. So they came up with American Pie, which is really not what the book, it wasn't only about American pizza, but they thought that was a clever title. So they came up with that. And then they let me keep the subtitle. And that's really what the book was about, is what it is. The book was my search, or what turned out to be sort of my quest for the difference between good pizza, of which there are thousands and thousands of pizzerias making good pizza. All pizza is pretty much good if you don't burn it. You can hardly screw up dough with something on it if you, you know, don't basically overcook it. But then there were a few places, and I wrote this book almost 20 years ago. Back then, there were maybe only a few dozen places in the United States, and if you add Italy and a few other, there were, you know, a number of others, but there were still a handful of places that were making pizza that was so good that it wasn't just good. It was great. And by great, I finally came to understand the word great in this context as meaning memorable. It was memorable, and it was like so good that you couldn't wait to go back. You couldn't wait to bring your friends, to bring your family members, you know, to impress people and say, this, I found the place. I'm obsessing over this place. And so there were a few places like that. There weren't hundreds of them. There were a few. Now, fast forward 20 years, and literally there are hundreds and maybe even, you know, more than 1,000 pizzerias in this country alone that are doing pizza of that quality. So the purpose of that book was to find out, what is it that the great pizzerias were doing the memorable pizzerias were doing that was differentiating them from the pack. And ultimately, the first thing that differentiated them was they all had a great crust. You can't have a memorable pizza without a great crust. And surprisingly, because it's not that hard to make a great crust, but many places just had a good crust, a serviceable crust, because their focus was more on the toppings. And, you know, they really, they obsessed over this tomato sauce. It was their grandmother's tomato sauce, or they had the different things that connected them to it that made it important to them. But the quality of the ingredients on top, or coming up with clever toppings, creative toppings, truffles and foie gras and all sorts of other stuff that would kind of set it apart, was something that chef-driven pizza restaurants were doing. But ultimately, if the crust wasn't great, then the best you could hope for on that pizza would be that it would be good and interesting. But interesting is not the same as memorable. And so I find that, you know, to me, I would say it's an 80-20 rule. 80% of what makes a pizza memorable is the crust. 20% is the toppings. Now, I took Jeffrey Steingarten, the great food writer from Vogue magazine, on a pizza hunt back, you know, when I was working on this book. And we went to DeFara's, the famous DeFara's Pizzeria in Brooklyn, which is, you know, being sort of touted as one of the last of the great, you know, old school pizzerias that everybody had to go to. You had to make a pilgrimage to DeFara's. And we went there, we went together, and in the car ride over, he said to me, listen, I got to warn you up front. He said, I'm really hard and fast about this. If it doesn't have a great crust, then forget about it. I don't care how good the rest of the pizza is. I'm not going to be in love with it. And he said, then I consider like the crust 90%. So he had a 90 to 10 ratio rule about what defined a great pizza. And when we had the pizza that day at the DeFara's, I thought, well, you know, this sauce really is good. There was something about the sauce that really popped in your mouth, kind of like the way Raoul's, you know, pasta sauce is better than other brands of pasta sauce. It was really good. And he had, you know, everything about the pizza was terrific, but the crust really wasn't memorable. And we both noticed it, but I didn't say anything. I wanted to see what he said. And he said, this pizza doesn't impress me very much. And I said, why not? He says, the crust is just, it's not crisp. It doesn't have any snap, blah, blah. So I said, I agree. And I called a friend of mine and I said, what's going on? This is supposed to be like the life-changing pizza. And he said, well, did you have them put it back in the oven and do the rebake? And I said, what do you mean the rebake? Ah. He said, DeFara's. What you have to do with DeFara's is you get it by the slice. You don't buy the whole pie. You get it by the slice and you tell them to put the slice back in the oven and it's during the rebake that the magic happens. And I go, geez, man, why didn't you tell me that before I wasted a whole trip to Brooklyn? You know, I live in North Carolina. Nobody had told me about this. Now, I'll never have to learn that lesson again. But the thing was, is that it's true. That pizzas that, you know, come out of the oven, you know, right out of the oven whole, within 5 minutes, the crusts are going to start to get soggy. And so the best way to get that wonderful, memorable, you snap in the crust is to throw that slice back in the oven for a couple of minutes to just re-crisp it. And so it might have passed the test if we had known that before we went there. But that's just an example of how important the crust is. So back to your question, Kara, which is, you know, where do you start? First, you have to understand how to make a great crust. And there's only a few basic rules to that. And one of those is make the dough at least a day ahead. Or if you're going to make pizza the same day, then do what Chris Bianco does, who's one of the greatest pizza makers in the world right now. He starts making his dough early in the morning, and he gives it all day to ferment. Yeah. And unless the dough has that long, slow fermentation, the fermentation activity and the enzyme activity that happens in the flour itself doesn't have enough time to release the flavors trapped in the flour. So as a bread making instructor, you know, at Johnson & Wales University, the first rule I teach my students is that it's not a rule, it's sort of like the mission. I say your mission while you're in this bread making class is to learn how to evoke the full potential of flavor trapped in the grain, in the flour. That's where it all starts. And you do that through applying the craft of bread making, which includes understanding fermentation. So, and the key to fermentation, it's not rocket science. It's just let time do its thing. You have the right balance of ingredients in there. And then one of those ingredients is time. And it takes anywhere from 12 to 18 hours for the enzymes, which are sort of the least known part of the flour, to do their trick, which is to break apart the starch molecules, the starch of the flour, of which the flour is like anywhere from 80% or so starch to protein. It breaks apart the starch molecules and releases the natural sugars that are in those starches, because that's what a starch is just complex sugar. But it takes time for those to be released. So that's just knowing that, just the one trick of taking like an old Betty Crocker pizza dough from, you know, one of those 1950s cookbooks and turning it into an artisan pizza dough is to make, instead of following their instruction, which is to give it like, you know, an hour and a half to rise and then shape it and then give it another hour and a half and then make your pizza. Just make the dough a day ahead, put it in the refrigerator, and the next day start making your pizzas, divide it and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. That one trick alone can take an average dough and turn it into a potentially great dough. So that's, you know, that's the first start of anyone who's on this quest to make a great pizza for themselves, is start with the dough. And then after that, you know, you can get into the down the rabbit holes of sauces and cheeses and oven temperatures and things like that.
I'd vibe with that. I vibe with the whole idea of the crust being everything. And crust means not just the crust, like bread crust, like the outside. It's the whole thing, the dough.
Yeah.
You know, how crispy it is, and a little bit of a chew to it.
Yeah.
Whether it's got a little darkened color, the crispy snap going right to the middle, you know, as opposed to the soft middle flopping down. And then the sauce and cheese hits you later.
Exactly. Exactly. And of course, the different styles of pizza, some styles are thicker crusted than others. So, you know, you have to kind of follow the steps and the principles for that style to get the maximum flavor. But in the end, it all comes down to evoking the maximum flavor, the full potential of flavor that's trapped in the ingredients, starting with the crust.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, have you made your own pizza dough before?
Oh, yeah. Whenever I make pizza, I do what Peter's saying. I make it the day before or very early in the morning for the evening. I actually follow, I just bought Peter's book. So or one of his books. I bought, Peter, you could tell me which one I bought. The one with the woman on the cover with the holding the loaf of bread. I bought that one.
Oh, that's the Bread Baker's Apprentice. That's my bread book. Yeah.
I'm going to dive into that for sure soon. But what I usually refer to is I usually do Jim Leahy's No Knead recipe, which is pretty high hydration and a long rise.
Yes.
And I've made bread with that recipe. I've made Detroit style. I've made pan pizza. I've made the hot pizza oven, pizzaola style. And it always comes out really great.
It's a great recipe and a great technique. And Jim gets a lot of credit and deserves a lot of credit for essentially applying the same concept of long, slow fermentation and the small amount of yeast and a wet sort of sticky dough to making great French bread in a cast iron pan or something like that. But the thing that makes it work when you kind of deconstruct the process is that it's allowed to sit overnight, usually at room temperature. It doesn't even have to go in the
room temperature because there's such little yeast in it.
It's got so little yeast that it can operate slowly. So the yeast doesn't use up all the sugar. It doesn't eat the sugar and turn it into alcohol, which could happen if you let the dough over ferment. Mm-hmm. But by using a small amount and then giving it time, then the enzymes have a chance to catch up and do their work. And that's kind of like, I think, in the last 10, 15 years of both pizza and bread communities understanding the process itself, enzymes have come to play a much more important role. It's not like you have to add enzymes. The enzymes exist within the flour themselves. There's both enzymes that affect starch and there's enzymes that affect proteins. They're there. And if you feel that your flour is lacking in some enzymes, they can take barley malt or barley flour, malt it, sprout the barley and activate. It's loaded with amylase enzymes, and they add those enzymes into the flour to give it more of the sweeter browning qualities that properly fermented flour will have. So again, it's all a balancing act between time, temperature, and ingredients. But time is one of the ingredients, and you can actually control the whole process by controlling both the time and the temperature. You can use a cooler temperature and extend the time, or you can use a warmer temperature and accelerate the time. And it's finding the proper balance between that and its effect on the ingredients that ultimately determines whether you're going to make a great loaf of bread or a great pizza crust or just an average or even an over-fermented version.
It's Kara, doesn't it sound like you just described almost like cheese making a little bit there in a way too, right?
It's
with the amylase and
very,
the
it's very
enzymes.
Similar. Yeah. Oh. I'm really fascinated by how much of this vibe is like, you know, just like, so Peter, you talk a lot about philosophy in pizza, and I feel like Joe, you're mentioning it here too. Like there's just this way of like thinking with fermentation, going with it, being patient. And then also like just the energy around everything you're making with your hands. It's really cool to see like something so simple like pizza, like cheese can be something more. Peter, is that what, how you feel about pizza and your pizza quest? Is that what you mean when you talk about like your quest for things?
Yeah. Like on my website, Pizza Quest, we even have this as sort of a subtitle, you know, well, we have a couple subtitles, and one is sort of a search for self-discovery through pizza. But then it's really, then the next mission statement beyond that is it's a celebration of artisanship wherever we find it, because the principles that drive great pizza making or great bread making, as we've just been discussing them, apply to other crafts, other artisan crafts. Cheese making being obviously one of them. Beer making is very prominent these days. It's, you know, winemakers. It applies to everybody who's, in fact, fermentation is really the great umbrella over all of this. And so bread making and pizza making and cheese making, they all fall under the umbrella of fermentation. So when you go to an event like the fermentation, what is it called? The Fermentation Festival in Wisconsin, the Firm Fest, they call it, you know, they have craftspeople of all different types of fermentation. They have people doing mezcal whiskeys. We've got people doing cheeses and bread and you name it. But certainly in Wisconsin, being the cheese, you know, epicenter that it is, there's a lot of focus on cheese. What I find is that cheese making is every bit as fascinating as bread making and dough making, maybe more so. It's more complex. It has maybe more stringent rules of engagement in terms of how sensitive the ingredients are to subtle variations in temperature and the introduction of certain, you know, microbes and this and that. So you really have to be much more meticulous. I started out as a cheesemaker 35, 40 years ago, thinking I wanted to become, you know, a cheesemaker. I was living in Sonoma County, California. There was a great Portuguese cheese guy named Joe Matos that was around the corner. We used to buy his cheese all the time. And I said, you know, I want to get into cheesemaking. I had access to some really good milk and thought, oh, I'll open a little cheese creamery. And then when I found out how stringent the rules were to be able to do it right, and first of all, to get approved by the Board of Health, but also to make sure you didn't ruin it and screw it up. And these same kind of principles applied to winemaking and beer making, whereas in bread making, there's much more leeway for being a few degrees off. There was, you know, it was much more tolerant of human error. And since I didn't have the precision skills and the scientific drive back then that kind of came later, you know, I went for bread. I said, I can do this much easier without all the rules. I can get the Board of Health to let me open a bakery before I can get them to let me open a cheese creamery. And so I went that direction. But I never lost my love for cheese. I just never was able to drill deep into cheese the way I've been able to do with bread. And that's why I love talking with you guys.
Oh my goodness. Who would have thought that cheese would be the tougher one there? I think that's really cool to hear, actually.
You've done it all.
They were kind of goofy people usually. So it's, it's kind of fun to hear that.
But we're all, you know, all of us who get into these kinds of things we're kind of goofy in our own way. We're eccentric. Because, you know, it's not like becoming a computer programmer or something where, you know, this is the future. This is like going into the future by going back into the past. We always say that the future of bread lies in its past. And I think that's true with, you know, all the great crafts, especially anything that's driven by fermentation. You know, it's ancient. It's ancient, and we're still as ancient as it is, and as long as it's been around, we're still finding new ways to peel back the layers of that onion, you know, to get to the core of it.
Yeah, totally. Well, so that's awesome, Peter. Okay, we're gonna do a quick break with that sentiment because that was very cool. Hey, everyone, you're listening to Cutting the Curd. I have Peter Reinhart with me, and we will be right back.
Forever Cheese, a leading importer of cheese and specialty food, has sourced exceptional products from Italy, Spain, Portugal, and Croatia for 25 years. Offering a wide selection of artisan cheese, charcuterie, nuts, crackers, preserves, and more, their products are sold in stores nationwide. Forever Cheese seeks out the best of the Mediterranean and focuses on sharing stories from their family of producers. Each product has a unique story, and their goal is to celebrate each one. From Drunken Goat to genuine Fulvi Pecorino Romano, Mostarda to Mitica Marcona Almonds, and Duya to Jamon Iberico, Forever Cheese is proud to offer products they love from people they believe in. Their passion, quality, and range are unmatched. Learn more at forevercheese.com and look for their products in a grocery store, restaurant, or specialty food shop near you.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Cutting the Curd. I'm here with Peter Reinhardt, masterpiece, pizza maker, bread expert. I'm also here with Joe Salonia, my buddy, my co-host, and we are just stoked to be talking about pizza. Next up on this half of the show, we're going to talk about pizza trends, pizza expos, and just the never-ending quest for delicious, awesome pizza and the cheese that goes with it. So actually, I'm going to throw it over to Peter now because I'm curious. I always hear about Pizza Expo now, and I want to know, what makes a Pizza Expo? What is cool at Pizza Expo now?
I just came back from Pizza Expo about 3 weeks ago. It's held in Las Vegas every year. There's a smaller version of it held in Atlantic City on the East Coast in the fall, which is about a third of the size of the Vegas Expo. But in Vegas, about 10,000 pizza freaks show up. Many of them are in the industry itself. They're there to make deals with their suppliers and to see some, you know, see competitions and kind of keep up with how this fast moving category of and craft. But then there's also the public shows up because it's a chance to come in and meet the great pizza makers and do a lot of tasting. And so we're in the convention center in Las Vegas, 10,000 people a day coming through this place. I'm not sure how many hundreds of booths of every kind of equipment and ingredient and boxes and, you know, also POS systems, business systems, everything, you know, to help you become a successful pizza operator and some amazing pizzas. And one of the things that I like about going, because I'm not in the pizza restaurant game anymore, I'm a consultant. I go in and help them fix their doughs when they call me, you know, because sometimes that's all they need is just to get their dough to another level. And that's my specialty. So
can I ask you about that?
Yeah.
A little bit right there. Like, cause I live in Northern New Jersey and there's just like a lot of good places, but there's a lot of bad places and it's all the dough usually.
Yeah.
What's the problem you see with the dough? Is there a common denominator where you're fixing the same problem with many of them?
It's hard to say because it depends. I usually, the first thing I'll ask them is, you know, tell me your process. And sometimes the process is that they're just not giving enough time to the dough to unwind those complex flavors, or sometimes they're not baking at a hot enough temperature, or they don't have control of their environment. You know, so some days are hot, some days are cold. Sometimes their oven is just not the right oven for the kind of pizza they're trying to make. So it kind of depends. All of those things are factors. But, you know, most of the time, and in New Jersey is like New York. You know, the folks there in the pizza business take pizza really seriously, and there's a lot of pride. There's a number of styles of pizza that come out of Jersey, including like the tomato pies of the Trenton area, and then most of the northern Jersey pizzerias are more in the New York pizza style. And in the southern Jersey area, they're a little bit more like Philadelphia and southern Jersey are kind of like, you know, closer to allied than the way that northern Jersey is to New York. And then there's this pride. And in fact, a lot of Jersey itself is becoming almost like as important a moniker as New York for pizza. Like you say, I make Jersey style pizza. The best pizzeria in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I live now, is called Gino D's. And it says, you know, on the sign, Jersey style pizza. And he's so proud of having a Jersey style pizza. And so I asked him, you know, what is it that makes it Jersey style? What are you doing that makes it Jersey style? And he says, it's because I'm from Jersey and I'm making the pizza. And so for him, it's about, you know, the identification of this place that in his mind, you know, his connection to pizza is that the people of that area, I think the other thing he said was, we make it with love. You know, not everybody says that about their cooking, but when he says, we make it with love, you know, you can feel it. You can feel the passion when he even says the words. He's not just spouting words. He's feeling them as he says them. And so there's that kind of intensity, I think, with that style. So I don't think that anybody who's not making great pizza in Jersey is going to last long unless they do get it fixed. And sometimes it could be the day, you know, some days are maybe better than others. Sometimes you can't train your staff to do what you want them to do. There's one person there who knows how it should be, but they can't get buy-in from the team, or if they're not there on the day, you know, on their day off, things don't go right. But if you have a pizza there that you think, you know, isn't meeting the mark, geez, do me a favor and tell them to call me.
I will. I find like it's...
Because we can usually fix it.
I feel like the subpar pizza places are perpetuating themselves because people, they don't know the difference anymore, because then they're comparing it to the subpar, to the subpar, to the subpar. And then out of those, they'll have a favorite and they're all just not hitting it. And then they're lucky if they find the good one. It might be luck. They're not really foodies, you know.
Do you have any, Joe, near where you live that you would rate that would kind of meet that criteria that we talked about earlier of memorable pizza?
Place, oh, yeah.
That you obsess over.
I'm still dreaming of it. I went to Raza in Jersey City. Just
oh, Raza, yeah. So that's become
just wow.
Yeah, Raza is the poster boy of today. You know, it's the Dan Richer is killing it there in Jersey City. About 20 years ago, the place everyone was buzzed about was in Phoenix, Arizona, called Pizzeria Bianco, Chris Bianco's place.
Oh, I want to go there.
And the highest compliment somebody can get today is to be called the new Chris Bianco, and I think that. Raza Pizzeria is kind of the new Pizzeria Bianco.
Well, I've not had both, but Chris Bianco looks like a wizard. I mean, I've been following him a long time too. Yeah. But I have not been to Phoenix.
He for a long time has been the standard bearer of sort of establishing this movement of what we're now generally calling artisan style pizza, meaning that there's a person behind it, you know, who's really taking the craft seriously and creating pizzas that. They just change your mind about what pizza can be. So the first time that I ever ate at Pizzeria Bianco, over 20 years ago, I was with a group of people. And when we left the restaurant, people were shaking their heads and going, I didn't know pizza could be this good, this much better than what I grew up with. And it was that noticeably great. And it was all about the crust. I mean, the toppings were terrific, but it was all about the crust. There was a snap, there was a creaminess, but beneath the snap, there was just something that you knew it as soon as you bit into it, that this is on a different level. And I think that's what everyone's shooting for now. And more places are doing it. And Raza is one of those places that's setting a standard. And one of the things he's doing differently than even Chris Bianco is he's doing it with a sourdough crust. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge trend right now. You're going to see this trend get bigger and bigger in pizza. Anthony Mangieri at Una Pizza Napoletana in the village is also, he's been doing it for 20 some years and was just recently cited as having maybe the best pizzeria in the world. He's always done his with a natural sourdough starter, but until recently yeast has been the default fermentation, you know, source, the leavening source. More and more pizza makers, because they've kind of surrendered to the craft itself and they've been captivated by this whole idea of natural fermentation with sourdough starters, more and more are going that direction. And Dan is one of them. And so it's just going to keep growing and growing. And it brings another element to the quality of the crust. It brings a complexity of flavor that you can't get through just yeast fermentation.
Ooh, mm-hmm. I want to try that.
Carol, we're going to go there.
I want to guess.
Tell me if this analogy holds. You'll know this because you're in the cheese world. I would think one analogy would be the difference between a cheese made from raw unpasteurized milk versus cheese made from pasteurized milk, and because typically the unpasteurized milk has a lot of biological activity going on in it, whether you add anything to it or not, and so you know as somebody from outside the cheese world, just sort of we look at it superficially, we hear. Raw milk cheese is on another level. It's kind of like the sourdough bread of cheese making. Would that be a fair analogy?
I think it's pretty close. Joe might say something. You know, it depends on who the cheesemaker is. I think it really comes down to that. But Joe will probably tell you that raw milk is you know, the best idea. I think it is definitely a quality you want to have in your cheese, but I think you can also get away with a really good pasteurized cheese. But again, it goes to the cheese recipe itself. I mean, what do you think, Joe?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I what you said, you know, you can just because something is raw milk doesn't mean you're going to it's going to be a superior flavor profile. I mean, I think you're behooves you to if you can make it in a world where that's allowed and you can go for it. But there's a beauty to having pasteurization, I guess, you know, you can control things and,
exactly.
and you know, and have more consistency. Raw milk, you're more, you know, living up to many other elements.
And I would think it would take maybe a little bit, one more level of skill, you know, to make sure that you can do it on a consistent basis. Everybody can get lucky once in a while, but can you do it day after day after day? And so you could say the same thing about, you know, a pizza crust. A pizza crust, if you use sourdough starter, it doesn't mean your pizza crust is automatically going to be better. It just has the potential to be more complex. But most of the great pizzas that exist are made with yeast.
Peter, I was going to ask you, is this sourdough recipe in your latest Pizza Quest book? Did one of the pizza luminaries get that recipe into the book by any chance?
My very first book, American Bite, did not get into sourdough pizza because that was 20 years ago. And nobody it was just about then that Anthony Mangieri just started coming out and doing it. But the last two, which is one's called Perfect Pan Pizza, which focuses on pizzas made in pans, like Detroit style and Sicilian stuff. And also the new one called Pizza Quest, which showcases 30 of the best pizza makers, you know, in America and takes their ideas. Both of those books do have recipes and formulas for how to make a sourdough pizza dough. In both books, I have, I think, 4 or 5 pizza dough recipes. Most of them are made with yeast, but then there's one for those who are willing to kind of jump into the deep end and do sourdough, then they have to know, number one, how can I make a sourdough starter? Or if they don't have one, you know, or can't borrow one from somebody else, then how to make it from scratch and then how to keep it alive and perpetuate it. And so, yes, I feel like you can't really do a new pizza book today without including sourdough because it's the future. Like I said, the future lies in the past, but there's a reason why it's coming back in a big way. Because when it's done well and done right, it creates a flavor profile that's just, again, one level more complex than you can get to any other way.
Yeah, I think that's very important. It almost sounds like one of your pizza commandments, because I think you had that. Maybe this was in the last book, maybe it was a different book, but I really enjoyed reading the 10 Commandments of Pizza. And I found that I'll read number 8.
That's in the new book.
That's in the new book. Okay, good. Okay, cool.
What was rule number 8?
Yeah, I like number 8. Yeah. So I'll read that to the listeners. Number 8 of the 10 Commandments of Pizza is, a recipe is a template, a guideline, but it is not law. Understand the letter, but follow the spirit. So I thought that was very cool. And then I'll just read number 10, and you can elaborate more on the commandments. Number 10 was, tradition should be honored and respected, but as a verb, not a noun. Pizza tradition is constantly expressing itself anew in the ever present now. I mean, this is like the Tao of pizza. It's so cool. How did you get to this point?
That's it. It's the Tao of pizza. Yeah. That, maybe we should have called the book the Tao of pizza.
That's a good title for a book.
That would be great. That could be the title of my next book. Thank you.
There you go. Grab that one.
But yes. It kind of goes hand in hand with my own personal background. I got into cooking and baking as an outgrowth of ministry. I was living in a semi-monastic community in California studying theology and training to become a priest. But I also had this background prior to that of, you know, cooking and having a hippie restaurant back in the early 1970s in Boston. And so somehow the food and the spirituality kind of wove together. And before I knew it, my ministry had started expressing itself through cooking. And in the community I was in, you could be married, you could have a family. And so my wife and I were both good cooks, and we opened a cafe in Forestville, California, in Sonoma County. And we made our own bread as well as do it all our own home cooking there. And somehow the bread, not knowing that this was sort of run off and have a life of its own, the bread got such a following that we ended up having to eventually close the restaurant and go full-fledged into baking and into bread. And at that point, I started writing about it. And so my first book was, the name of the bakery was called Brother Juniper's Bakery. And we called the subtitle was Slow Rise as Method and Metaphor. And so that subtitle, again, the subtitles are always like the real title of my books. The subtitle really said it all. The whole thing was driven by the idea of slow fermentation creating better quality bread, or slow is better than fast. And so that became the driving metaphor of every book I've written since, 13 books later. That's really what all 13 books are about, is these values, these sort of universal spiritual values that I think add to a more enhanced and fulfilling life. Ultimately, the real themes of all my books is the quest for a fulfilling life. And we use the craft itself as the metaphor for try to tell that story.
Yeah, cheers to that.
What cheese makes its way onto your pizza? Is it the obvious? Is it mozzarella? I've been dying to ask this all the whole time. Sorry.
You can't go wrong with mozzarella because there's a reason why it's used so much. It's easy to make, number one. And it's whether it's the fresh mozzarella or the, you know, sort of the low moisture aged mozzarella that comes in the bag, shredded and all that, because it melts so well. It's a good melting cheese. It doesn't have a lot of flavor. It's in fact, I prefer using something like provolone or fontina because they're much more complex in flavor, but they're not. I think provolone might fall under the, one of them falls under the pasta filata category of cheese. Yep. And the other one falls under the soft, medium soft cheese, but they're both of them have more fermentation time. And as a result, more flavor development, but mozzarella is a great sort of, it's kind of like the vanilla ice cream of cheeses for pizza. It works. It's creamy. It's cheesy. It's, you know, it has a great stretch to it. And then if you want more complexity, you can go start on the other end of the spectrum and go with the dry aged cheeses, like whether it's, you know, sort of the Parmesan style or the sheep's milk style. You know, you can get the salty umami flavors more from the dry aged cheeses, and again, just finding the right balance, and then everything in between. Whether it's, you know, whether it's a Swiss cheese Joe and I, tomorrow, I'm excited because Joe, you're going to come on my podcast tomorrow and we're going to talk about cheese and we're going to specifically focus on Swiss cheeses. And so I'm going to learn as much as I can from you about the different styles of Swiss cheese. But there's not one kind of Swiss cheese, right? There's many types of Swiss cheese that fall under that sort of general category of, I don't know, what is it Alpine? Is that the, so
yeah, there's lots.
Those cheeses certainly could work on a pizza. There's certainly pizzas of the world that are built around those.
And for mozzarella, though, like if you just look at the mozzarella category, or mozzarella, or fior di latte, buffalo mozzarella, yeah. you got the low moisture, the whole milk, the low moisture and the shred, and then you have your fresh mozzarella in brine. You have your salted rolled saran wrappy one, and then you have mozzarella curd. I've put just mozzarella curd on a pizza.
I love mozzarella curd,
and it didn't bleed out all the extra water. It was nice, and I adjusted it with salt. So what out of that kind of grouping, though, what do you think you'd reach for?
Well, I like what you said. I'm a big fan of using curds on cheese like that. Mm-hmm. It has a different texture. It's a little more chewy, a little more rubbery, you know. But it's wonderful. And so I think, you know, we're going to see more of that. We're going to see more people just buying cheese curds, and instead of because like if you go to a place like Pizzeria Bianco that we spoke of earlier, mm-hmm. he starts each day. Aside from making his dough, and usually Chris Bianco's brother makes the dough, and it's aging. While it's aging, Chris and his team are making cheese. They're taking cheese curds, adding hot water to it. A lot of pizzerias are doing this now, and making their own in-house mozzarella cheese, fior di latte from cow's milk cheese. And so the way you make it is you pour hot water over it, and you kind of like get in there with it and knead it, and you squeeze it and everything, and it starts to melt. And it extrudes some of the moisture that's in the cheese itself, and you get this long, silky cheese that you can form into a dough, into a little ball, like a softball. So you're taking the exact same ingredients and just reformulating them into something that can later be used. You know, it's changed enough so that it can be shredded, and you do all sorts of stuff with it. But it starts with the curd, And so, and the, and basically you can use cheddar curds, you can use, you know, mozzarella curds. They're just less complex in flavor, but they're fun and easy to work with, and they have their own textures. So I like that. Mm-hmm. And then the other styles of mozzarella, like one of the big issues is, should I use full fat mozzarella made with whole milk, or should I use partially skimmed mozzarella? Mm-hmm. And what's the pros and cons of that? With the full fat mozzarella, of course, tastes better because fat makes everything taste better. So so it's wonderful. But of course, then you get a little oily pizza, and some people don't like that. They don't want to have to take a paper towel and sop up any oil that's coming off the top of their pizza. But the other thing is that when you have a full fat pizza, full fat mozzarella, the cheese doesn't brown up as quickly. It doesn't get that golden caramelized quality that you get from a lower fat mozzarella. So a lot of pizzerias use either exclusively what they call, I think they call it part skim or low fat mozzarella, part skim milk, or they'll use a blend of full fat and low fat cheeses because they get a more golden caramelization on the cheese. So these are like, again, nuanced choices that each pizza maker, being the craftsperson that he or she is, and speaking of he or she, there's a lot more women now stepping to the helm and becoming, you know, well-known and famous as pizza makers. That whole category is exploding as well. But it's all about the craft. And I think that's what's drawing people, is that within the simplicity of making pizza, there's a tremendous amount of choices that are craft-driven that can make the difference between a good pizza and a great or memorable pizza. And that's what's driving the movement, is people don't want to just make an everyday pizza. They're not in the game just to make money. They want to make money, but they're not just there to make money. They're there to make a mark, to become the next Pizzeria Bianco or the next Dan Richer. They want to be the next big name in the thing. And they enter competitions. They go to Italy and compete against the Italians. I mean, it's the whole movement of artisan pizza is being driven by the fact that people are searching to make pizzas that people can obsess over. And because they're obsessed with the pizza making themselves, they want their customers to be just as obsessed about eating them.
Yeah, Peter, that's so much information there. I mean, I have like so much I want to ask you, but we're almost at the end of our show. I know we didn't get to pizza ovens. We didn't talk about white pizza. Joe, what were you going to say? I think you had something else you were going to mention just now.
I'm just saying I want to eat it all, and just thinking of cheeses, I mean, it's endless. What can really be, the word poutine pizza even popped in my head, thinking of cheese curds and like gravy, and I mean just pizza could just be so many things, especially when it involves you know, delicious cheeses.
I think that would be a really cool pizza, Joe. A poutine pizza would that be cool or what?
Oh my god, I think so. I mean, it'd be something different, but I mean,
if they can have buffalo chicken, you can have poutine pizza.
hell yeah, you could. Yeah, I just the other day, I'm a true confession. I'm going to confess. The other day, I had pineapple and ham pizza.
Whoa!
Well, you just opened another Pandora's box, which I was going to bring it up earlier. But I was going to say, you know, that's you know, a category that, well, you can get into some serious, you know, philosophical debates with people over, but I don't think that's really debatable. I think that people who say that it's an abomination to put pineapple on a pizza are wrong. They're just dead wrong because it violates the flavor rule. And so the criteria is that simple, is what's wrong with making a pizza that tastes great just because it's not what you would get in Italy. And I think that for me, it's not, I don't, you know, I think it's a pointless argument, but it's a fun argument to have because people feel so passionate about it, but they're kind of irrational about it. It has nothing to do with their understanding.
The crust was great. It was crispy. It's one of my favorite Northern New Jersey spots. It's been around since the 60s. And yeah, that's one of the varieties they make. But they've been making it since the early 80s, whenever that trend started.
For people who are opposed to it, it's an emotional opposition. It's not based in culinary, you know, knowledge. It's based on an emotional thing of that's not how I grew up with it. That would be, you know, my grandmother would roll over in her grave, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But the guy who came up with it was not Hawaiian. He was a restaurant owner in Canada who recognized that that the Chinese, he loved Chinese food. And, you know, think about like sweet and sour pork and things like that, or, you know, how much pineapple is used in Asian cooking. And he said, there's something about that combination of savory meats and fruits like pineapple that work together to create a whole other kind of flavor synergy. And so he came up with that idea, and he called it Hawaiian pizza because of the pineapple in it, not because he was Hawaiian. And so, of course, it took on a life of its own, but it's based in a true culinary principle, which is the use of contrasting flavors to create a new flavor experience in your palate, you know, based on how those flavors contrast with each other. So how about if we save that conversation for the next time? Because I'd love to come back with you guys in the future if you'll have me back. Absolutely. And we can go into some of the things we didn't cover this time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. I love how polarizing pizza is. And I will just say, long live the flavor rule, Peter. Thank you so much for that. That's amen to that.
All right. Yeah. Flavor rule rules.
Exactly.
And Sarah, since you have the book in front of you, do you remember the 11th? Do you remember the 11th commandment of the 10? I had 10 commandments of pizza, and then on the last page, I have the 11th commandment.
Oh, my goodness. No, I didn't study that hard. Okay, so what is it?
The 11th commandment is, let me see. It's so funny. Now, as I ask you the question, my mind just went blank. The 11th commandment is, here it is. It's more about the quest than it is about the pizza, and the quest never ends.
There you go. Mm. It never ends. It keeps on. It's infinite.
I do feel like that. I'm always on the hunt.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you, Peter, for coming on the show today. This was a hoot. Joe and I had so much fun. We were really looking forward to this. So thank you for coming on today.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to it as well. Yeah. And I'm looking forward to meeting with Joe. We're gonna continue the conversation on the Pizza Quest side. And maybe we can just bounce back and forth on each other's shows from time to time.
That sounds great.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm going to tell the listeners where to find you now. So
thank you, guys.
Please follow Peter on Instagram at PizzaQuesting or go to his website, fornobravo.com/PizzaQuest. Follow us at Cutting the Curd and myself at Kara Warren. You can follow Joe at Sting Chef. And please listen, subscribe to Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, don't forget to give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It might help widen our audience. Awesome. All right, guys. Enjoy. Thanks. And eat more cheese.
Cutting the Curd is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.